In the 70s, Canadian artist Joni Mitchell wrote a song about the environment that went, "Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?" Big Yellow Taxi was a huge hit, and most will remember the song as fun, but actually, she wrote it to snap people out of their environmental complacency. It's about taking Mother Nature for granted, and the lyrics, 50 years later, are even more relevant. When people have access to nature, it makes their lives better, but it's a resource that's undervalued in economics and pretty much left off the balance sheets.
If they had to, many people would in fact pay for a cleaner lake or more wildlife in their backyard. But they don't even have to. They can get it for free. That's often mistaken by people to think, well, therefore there's no economic value. And that's not right. I'm Kathy Kling. I'm an environmental economist at Cornell University. I'm a Tisch University professor in the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management.
Catherine Kling, like Joni Mitchell, believes trees are worth more in the forest than in a museum, and she's focused much of her career on creating the kind of data that encourages governments to include the value of nature into their economic decision-making.
If you cut down the trees, that adds to GNP, because you've now got something you sell. That's all good stuff. Obviously, you want to do that. But if you're cutting it down faster than you're regrowing it, well, there ought to be a little bit of a negative from the drawdown of the size of the forest.
You're cutting down on the natural patrimony of the nation.
Yes, exactly.
In this special episode of our Women in Economics series, environmental economist Catherine Kling and journalist Rhoda Metcalf discuss why paving paradise to put up a parking lot may not deliver the highest returns.
When we think about the value of nature, you know, the pleasure we might get from canoeing or swimming on a lake, or even watching birds fly into our backyard, it's hard to imagine how you could put a price tag on that. But that's what you spend most of your career doing, right?
Yep.
Can you explain how you do that kind of calculation and why it matters that you do?
It matters enormously. And it matters because our government makes a lot of decisions with our money. And some of those decisions impact the amount of nature, environmental quality, air pollution, and water pollution that we have to live with. Those things are not bought and sold in markets, typically. And so it's very easy to sort of leave those off the table because they're harder to think about in economic terms.
The value that society gets from them.
The value, and you framed it very nicely. People spend a lot of time in nature. They spend a lot of time fishing, swimming, grabbing a six-pack and heading down to the lake and watching their kids flop around in the water. That is something they're enjoying just in the same way as when they go to the movies, just in the same way when they go to a restaurant. But in the latter two, there are market signals that show up in GDP and all the measures. But when it's going to the lake and enjoying birds and watching your kids have a blast dunking each other in water that you feel comfortable is clean enough for them to be in, that doesn't show up in the ledgers in the same way. That's often mistaken by people to think, well, therefore there's no economic value. Economic value just means that it's something that we enjoy, that if we had to, we would pay for. And so the work that I do and others of my ilk is to come up with methods that can allow us to figure out how much would people be willing to pay if they had to. Why is that important? So that we can inform government about how much money, how much of our taxpayer dollars should be allocated to water quality improvement, as opposed to infrastructure on roads, or as opposed to education, very important things as well, easier to hang a dollar tag on.
Right. So if the objective in all of this is protecting nature, I mean, how do you go about calculating the economic benefit or economic value to us in society of a lake, like a clean lake?
So one way in which we do this is we look at the prices of houses that are located right on or near a beautiful, clean, pristine lake. Mm-hmm. And we contrast that to houses that are similar, but on a dirty lake. And we find huge values. And there are a number of people, including myself and co-authors, but many people before me that have done this type of work. Water quality, in the way I just described, is one of the areas. But there's also very strong evidence that there's real estate capitalization, we call it, that values are altered by polluted cities versus cleaner cities, toxic waste, many, many examples of this kind of analysis and thinking through how can we infer based on some market transactions.
Right.
Now, that is only going to work for the stock of housing that is near a lake.
Right.
Most people do not live near lakes. And so for them, a very common way is to collect data of how far they travel to get to those lakes. Do they travel further to cleaner lakes? They were willing to take more time and put up with the kids screaming in the back seat for a longer period of time,
right,
so that they could go somewhere that's nicer. How much further? How much does that cost them in gasoline and time? That then gives us a clear indication of the value they placed on a cleaner lake than a dirty lake. Hmm. That's another very common approach that really helps us nail down those values for a big chunk of the population.
That's great. I know that you've done a lot of your research. Certainly most of your earlier research was out of the Iowa State University, right, where you were a professor.
Yes.
For a long time?
Yep.
So I guess about, 6 years ago, you moved to Cornell, is that right?
Yes.
And since you've been there, you've launched some really fascinating studies, including one that revolves around the Clean Water Act, right?
Yes.
So just explain to us, first of all, what is the Clean Water Act and, you know, why is it important?
Clean Water Act had its 50th anniversary last year, along with the Clean Air Act. Those are the primary federal legislation that protects our waters and air.
Okay.
And this legislation has many regulations, many requirements that have led to, in the case of the water pollution, enormous improvements in water quality.
Right. And the Clean Water Act has led to a lot of limitations, right, on pollutants going into rivers and so on.
Yes. Companies used to just dump their waste in the waterway. Now that waste has to be filtered. They have to remove the vast majority of pollutants and things like toxics, oil, grease, a wide range of pollutants have hugely been improved. There are some really impressive pictures you can see of waterway pictures taken in the 1970s, and then a picture flash forward to now, and you wouldn't even recognize how wonderful the improvement has been. Hmm. That said, there are still a few areas where we have not succeeded in making progress. And
right.
So part of the work I'm doing now, and there's, of course, many others working on this as well, is to get a better handle on the costs of those pollutants that have yet not been controlled the same way that many have been.
So what are we talking about here? I mean, what were you trying to capture in your study?
For example, the water quality benefits of small rivers and streams.
Mm-hmm.
So iconic lakes and large lakes, it has been easier to get a handle on how much people use those. But many of us live in communities where there's rivers and streams all around us.
Right.
And some of those are large enough for us to canoe and raft in. Others are just things we walk by every day. The values associated with water quality there have not been generally incorporated. Likewise is habitat.
Mm-hmm. Animals and such.
Animals, wildlife, bird watching and fishing. That wildlife depends on water, right. And it depends on reasonably clean water. And so our work has been to try to bring a broader array of those values into benefit cost analysis so as to be getting a better overall picture of the benefits.
So, I mean, I assume that the more benefits of nature that you're able to account for, that is going to push governments to put more money into their budgets for conservation.
A logical government, yes. And that's what we hope for. So the short answer is yes. Just to be clear, as a university researcher, my goal is not advocacy. In my personal life, I have, you know, my views and my advocacy. But in my professional life, the goal here is to really do benefit cost analysis right. And on occasion, sometimes there are costs that have not been well recognized right. and included. And those need to be too. So as we better understand the benefits, that should make logical sense then to preserve and improve nature more. But again, our goal is to get the information out there and use our tools as well as we can to inform decision making.
Yeah, interesting. I guess I'm wondering also whether, did you grow up in nature a lot yourself? Did you feel connected to nature? Is this in some ways why you moved in this direction of this kind
yep.
of research?
Absolutely. First 10 years I was in, we lived in a Detroit suburb, and almost every weekend, throw the kids in those giant old station wagons with no seatbelts and
right.
How we all survived it, in a cooler, and we'd head to the nearest lake. And my parents, especially my dad, would fish. We had a little rowboat.
Nice.
The kids would muck around in the water. We'd catch minnows, just very classic Midwestern. I like to think of it as sort of small nature. You know, we weren't going to big, impressive mountains. We did a little of that, but mostly we were just going to muck around and have a barbecue and do a little hiking and, you know, just really enjoy it. So when I went to college, I really loved economics. I just loved the way of thinking. It never occurred to me that there was a thing called environmental economics.
Right.
Then I went to graduate school, which is where the first place I heard there was. And my brain flipped. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can study things related to the environment and the natural world and do economics? No way, this can't be. And yeah, here I am, 30 years later, made a whole career out of it.
And when you went into this sort of environmental economics field, it was a pretty recent, pretty young field, no?
Very, definitely.
So how did that feel being in such a kind of new strata of economics?
So I ended up going to graduate school at one of the places that had some of the earliest leaders in environmental and natural resource economics, which is the University of Maryland. And at the time, I didn't really realize how nascent the field really was,
right.
because there were several universities, Maryland happened to be one of them, which were hotspots.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you were at a place like that, there were other people doing this in multiple faculty. Once I went on the job market and started learning more about other departments, I became aware that there were many, many places that had never heard of it, didn't do this weird thing. And it's still not uniformly taught. But with the onset of climate change and the biodiversity crisis and so on, I think just the reality of how important these issues and decisions are, a lot of the people in environmental economics also work on energy.
Right.
And of course, energy transitions is also huge. And again, that has led to very clear acceptance in many places.
Is that important to you, that your research has direct application to policy?
Oh, yeah. It's outstanding. When I started out as an economist,
You know, I had this sort of, well, I'm just going to be sitting in my office with a pad of paper and a typewriter. And the more involved I came, the more I realized, no, this can really make a difference in decision making. Mm-hmm. So most of us do kind of want to do something useful, or at least some of us in the ivory tower.
Right. Right. There's another study you did recently at Cornell, which I thought was very clever, in which you tapped into this huge population of passionate bird enthusiasts. I mean, all these avid birders around the world to learn about air pollution. Now, tell me a bit about that.
Cornell's Lab of Ornithology is the world premier institution on birds. And they have also the largest citizen science database in the world.
Right.
It's called eBird. Mm-hmm. And exactly as you said, it taps into the enthusiasm of birders all across the world who record the birds that they see, the time of day when they see them, how many, enormous detail, and put those on an app. And that fills out this huge database, which a group of statisticians and others at the lab take and use to come up with estimates of abundance of birds right. in different locations and at different times.
So it's sort of how these bird populations are doing.
Yes, exactly. And they are declining.
The birds are.
Bird numbers have been declining. And in talking about this with a colleague of mine who studies air pollution, he said, I wonder if air pollution, if we can learn anything about the relationship between birds and air pollution.
Right.
And so I went to the lab folks and said, bird people, can we sit down and talk? Right. And so we worked very closely with ecologists, Amanda Rodewald and others. And what we found is that the Clean Air Act and the regulations that it put in place right. had very big benefits for bird populations.
And this had something to do with ozone, right? It had something to do with...
Yep, yes, ozone. And it's ground-level ozone. The interesting thing I never would have known, and it's fun to learn from the ecologists, birds are little. Many birds are very little. And birds, they don't breathe in and out. Hmm. They continuously breathe in.
Huh.
And so, and so the gist of it is, they get twice the exposure to any kind of bad air. They also have very different respiratory systems. They're small. Their heartbeat goes really fast. So air pollution of certain types is basically going to mess with their whole body and be impacted.
Right.
So basically, we were able to quantify that at a large scale and basically say, look, we did this thing for humans, the Clean Air Act. It also turned to have wonderful co-benefits for non-humans, birds, probably any number of other wildlife through this really wonderful citizen science database.
And wasn't it the case that you had that the Clean Air Act affected part of the country more than the other part, and that's one of the ways you were able to compare?
Exactly. The air pollution has been worse along the East Coast.
Right.
It's where people are. That's where cars are. That's where lots of the power plants and so on are. So there was these standards that were put in place that applied only to part of the country. And they only applied to part of the year. That allowed us to figure out the counterfactuals is the way we would say mm-hmm. it. We need to see birds with air pollution and without,
right.
and before and after. And so, yes, that's exactly right.
And didn't you come up with some pretty interesting numbers around sort of how much birds were affected by air pollution?
Yes. We found very large impacts. Had those air quality regulations not been in place, the decline we would have seen in birds would have been 20 or 25% more. The bird losses would have been substantially worse.
So what's the economic element of this study? I mean, you're the economist in this. What does economics bring to that?
You know, one of the main things economics brought is the way of thinking about how to assess this data. And there would be some economists who would say, well, that's not really economics. That's kind of ornithology, epidemiology. That's fair enough. I don't really care what you call it. If it's good, careful analysis that answers really important questions, I think I'm very happy with that. That said, there is, in my mind, a very clear economic component, because before you can monetize things, you need to know what the impacts are. So if birds have value to people, and we know they do, in order to determine how valuable the Clean Air Act Amendment, for example, was in its role in saving birds, we need a sense of how many birds it saved.
So you've been focused on this work of sort of calculating the economic value of nature. Is this going to play a role, do you think, in some of the environmental battles of the future?
Oh, yeah. Well, I hope so. So let me tell you one thing that's happening that I think is super interesting. So everybody has heard of GDP.
Sure.
We're in a recession this year, or we're not in a recession, or the economy is chugging along at 3% increases, so on and so forth. That's all using data from gross domestic, gross national product.
Mm-hmm.
That omits completely the quality and sustainability of all of our natural systems and our natural capital, our trees, our clean water, our clean air, fish stocks. Well, that's going to change. Under the Biden administration, for the first time, the federal government is going to stand up natural environment accounts. And these accounts will be just like the standard economic accounts, but they will focus on the natural environment.
That's interesting.
So things like, what's the health of our forests? What's the size of our forests? Are we cutting it down faster than we're regrowing it?
Mm-hmm.
The goal is that in 15 years, when you turn on NPR and you get the report of what's going on, you know, we're moving into a recession, or we've had strong comeback out of a recession, they will say, and natural capital is, however, being depleted at 3% a year, which is faster than it was last year. So we get in that same kind of thinking on a parallel between what's the health, the stock of our natural resources, how is that increasing or decreasing vis-a-vis the economy, the economic activity. But otherwise, if you cut down the trees, that adds to GNP because you've now got something you sell.
Mm-hmm.
That's all good stuff. Obviously, that's we want to do that. But if you're cutting it down faster than you're regrowing it, well, there ought to be a little bit of a negative from the drawdown of the size of the forest.
You're cutting down on the natural patrimony of the nation.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. When are we going to start hearing those numbers coming out?
They're starting right now. It will be a long, like I said, they're not even planning for a full set to be available for 10 or 15 years. Turns out that that's exactly how GNP and all of those economic accounts were started 80 or 100 years ago. They took a 10-year period to figure out how to build those accounts,
right,
how to stand them up. So I find that to be really good news, because it means this is being done seriously so that we get numbers that are meaningful and not just politically correct for the time at which they're produced. We don't want these to be the Republican numbers or the Democrat numbers. These need to be independently done that really measure the stock of natural capital.
Well, Kathy Kling, it's been a wonderful conversation, very thought-provoking. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, this has been great. Really wonderful to be here. Thanks.
Catherine Kling is an environmental economist at Cornell University in the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management. She was speaking with Rhoda Metcalf. Go to business.cornell.edu to learn more about Kathy Kling's important work on putting an economic value on Mother Nature. Look for the other podcasts in our Women in Economics series at imf.org/podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at imf_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.